joining the Union Debating Society and the LGBT Society in St Andrews for one of our first collaborations in recent history. And we're hoping tonight is going to be a really great event and really encourage a lot of discussion. We've had a number of questions submitted in advance, really interesting ones, and we think that they'll lead the conversation. But please feel free, like in the style of question time, but without David Dimbleby pestering everyone, it won't be quite so aggressive, it will be a bit more interactive. Please feel free to raise your hand, ask questions, and make the discussion go on. So tonight, Leah Duchemin and myself. Leah, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, so my official title is LGBT officer, but that means nothing to no one. So essentially what I do is, since LGBT has become a subcommittee of the union, I am now the LGBT president of the LGBT society, as well as doing what the SRC member for sexualities used to do. So that's what I do, and I'm very happy to be here tonight and to see so many of you in this room.
That's great. And I'm the president of the EDS, and normally we have our debates aren't held like a panel. We have quite confrontational, quite often aggressive debates, which provoke quite... Well, a different atmosphere to what we've got tonight. So this is one of our first panel events for this year, but we're really interested in collaborating with other societies. So if you belong to another society going into this semester and the following semester, we'd be interested in pairing up with you. We're going to start by introducing the speakers that we have tonight. So first of all, if the speakers wouldn't mind just introducing themselves, saying a little bit about themselves and what brought them here to St Andrews. So Dr Chris Hooley, he's a regular of LPH.
Indeed so. No, of course not as regular as I'd like. My name's Chris Hooley. I've been here for 7.5 years or so. I'm a theoretical physicist, lecturer in the School of Physics and Astronomy, and I guess I'm more or less just here as a gay member of staff. Is that right?
My name's Stuart Hansen. I'm the founder of No Going Back. We're a charity, and all of you have got flyers on your seats, hopefully, explaining what we do and the legal services that we offer to gay asylum seekers in the UK. I'm also a magistrate at Leeds Magistrates Court. Thank you.
I'm Elisabetta Girelli. I'm a lecturer in film studies here. I've also been here about 7.5 years, and a lot of my work and teaching at the moment is on queer theory, queer cinema, and related issues.
I'm Paddy, and I work for Teach First, which is an education charity. I'm here for a few reasons, because I love coming back to St Andrews. I was a student here. And also because Teach First is working to make sure that we place a really diverse cohort of teachers in schools every year that represents the pupils that our teachers teach. And in our work, our work's in the very early stages, and I'm very involved in it, so I'm really interested to hear different people's points of views on issues like we're going to discuss tonight and how they tie into education.
My name's Kelvin Holdsworth. I'm the Provost of St Mary's Cathedral in Glasgow. I'm a gay man working at a senior level in the church, and I'm also an alumnus of the oldest and the greatest university in Scotland. So it's good to be back.
My name is Tom French. I'm the policy coordinator for the Equality Network, which is one of Scotland's national LGBT equality charities. My main role in the organisation is working with the Scottish Government and politicians on LGBT equality issues, and by working with, I mean pushing, prodding, and trying to get them to do things which are good for LGBT equality. And on your chairs, you can also see a flyer about the Equality Network's Equal Marriage campaign, which you're more than welcome to get involved in.
So I'd like to thank our 6 esteemed speakers for coming up from as far as London and across Scotland to be with us tonight. We're going to kick off the event with the first question, which has been submitted this week. It's a highly topical one, and one which we think that will really kick off the debate tonight. So, the first question is, what do you believe will be the most likely effect of the recent abdication of Pope Benedict on the LGBT community? We'd like to start with Calvin.
Why could I not see that coming towards me first? I think that the impact of this resignation is actually quite significant. I don't think people should get into their heads that when there's a new pope, everything's going to be okay for LGBT Catholics, and that all of a sudden rules are going to change or anything like that. That's not going to happen. What has happened, though, in this move, in resigning, I think the Pope has done something that's actually going to reform the papacy, probably over a few papacies, but what it means is the Catholic Church will be able to... Well, the cardinals who elect the next pope will be able to choose someone without thinking that they're going to be there forever. It opens the possibility of younger people being elected as pope. Who knows, perhaps not this time, but certainly by the next time, we could be seeing popes elected with the expectation that they'll serve to 65 or 70, rather than people who are being elected in their 70s, in their 80s, and then lasting the rest of their lives. We know that people who are younger tend to be more supportive of LGBT issues. There is no reason why that shouldn't be true of cardinals just as much as anyone else. So I feel quite positive about it.
Anyone else on the panel like to chip in with this one?
Yeah. So I started to feel less positive about it when I saw the interview that Cardinal Turkson, who's being tipped, gave to Christiane Amanpour on CNN, where he explicitly linked the... let me get this exactly right. He said that Africa had not been so touched by child molestation scandals because their culture tended to suppress homosexuality. This is, of course, something that we hear, and it's something that people think a lot more than they say. It's a really horrible thing that, in the teeth of all the evidence, it is still peddled in public that homosexuality has something to do with paedophilia. And, yeah, I got more worried that one of the people tipped as front-runner is publicly saying this kind of thing. So, in the longer term, I think I agree with some of the points made. In the immediate term, if he is the successor, I think it could get at least temporarily worse.
I agree with what Kelvin has said, that it has to be a good thing if now popes may be younger when they are elected and they may not be expected to be there forever. But I tend to share Chris's pessimism simply because my view of the history of the Catholic Church is such that I cannot believe that any pope, however young, whatever it comes from, would be significantly different in his treatment of homosexuality from every predecessor, because I don't think there's ever been a significant change in the way these issues are seen. So I don't think, actually, there would be any great difference, although I think it could be worse. But I would be... I can't imagine it get any better.
Does anyone else share Elisabetta's fears or have any hopes?
I think there's similar things about the gradual shift and potentially pessimism for the near future. Mm. But the change in the church will potentially be very, very gradual, and it will happen over time. So I think there's a lot of agreement there, actually.
Tom?
I have to agree with Chris. I'm fairly pessimistic. I want to preface that by saying that I think a large number, if not a majority, of Catholics or people who consider themselves to be Catholic do support LGBT equality. I think if you look at surveys like the recent Scottish Social Attitudes survey, that showed that over 50% of Catholics in Scotland support same-sex marriage, for example. But you still see in almost every country around the world where there is an established Catholic Church that it is more often than not the Catholic Church that has people paid to lobby against LGBT equality. If you take Scotland, for example, it has often been the Catholic Church that over the past 15, 20 years has led almost every major campaign against LGBT equality that there has been. So when Section 28 was being repealed, the Catholic Church was very heavily involved in the campaign to keep the homophobic Section 28. In the campaign against same-sex marriage, the Catholic Church has spent tens of thousands of pounds in Scotland alone lobbying the government and politicians, far more than any equality body has spent, to prevent LGBT equality progressing. And on the international stage, the words of the Pope and the actions of the Catholic Church as an institution in lobbying the United Nations on issues like LGBT equality has been incredibly detrimental to the progress that we could have made. So pessimistic. You know, I'm hopeful that, as Calvin says, there's going to be a younger generation that will be pushing for change. I do wish they'd perhaps be a bit more vocal. I know that's difficult, but...
I think for me personally, I'm not Roman Catholic, I'm Anglo-Catholic, but the church, when we look at the debate, the church is global, and there's a lot of young people in Africa who won't hold the same opinion, who are just as valid as the European Catholics, Roman Catholics. And it worries me that if we do get someone like Peter Turkson, who's from Ghana, and this week I had a phone call from somebody held in detention who'd actually been returned to Ghana. I can't see that. He's obviously played a huge part in his country, and he hasn't made any reforms at all or helped. Actually, there's rumour that he supported the Uganda homosexuality bill, and that really does worry me in my kind of role where I'm going to be out there trying to support these people, where the Roman Catholic Church is potentially going to be my enemy in the future, an even stronger enemy.
I think that leads us on. Does anyone else have any questions that you'd like to chip in over the recent abdication of the Pope? We'll move on to the marriage reforms. And the
Maybe about the Church of England and the Church of Wales, if you have any comments on that, any thoughts.
Me again. We're doing religion first tonight. Well, one of the things that Tom alluded to is the fact that denominations are not united about marriage reform. Very often leaders of churches have very clear voices and very anti-voices, very negative voices. Then that's not universally true, but that's very often the case. Tom's absolutely right in saying that, in fact, the religious body that's most supportive, if you look at the membership of same-sex marriage in Scotland, is the Catholic Church, which is a huge paradox and a great surprise. But generally, Catholics believe in marriage. Generally, Catholics believe in family life. Generally, Catholics believe that marriage is a sacrament. And if you generally ask Catholics, they say, well, why shouldn't gay people have the access to that? The same is true in most denominations. There is a split of opinion. The proposals that have been concocted in England make it more difficult for the Church of England to opt into the legislation that's being proposed, and the Church of Wales. Seems to me that it's nuts particularly for the Church of Wales, because that's the church in Wales, because that's a disestablished church anyway. They need to have the right to make their own decisions, and I expect that to unravel during the legislative processes. I can't see that will stick. I'm an Anglican, that means an Episcopalian, that means that I relate to the Church of England. If I'm in England, I'm supposed to think of myself as a member of the Church of England, though sometimes I struggle a wee bit over the issues that they have around women and the issues that they're promoting about LGBT people. And yet, I know countless people who are supportive, who are longing for change. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's people like me around who have been lobbying, have been active. I mean, I've been involved with Tom and the Equality Network campaigning. I want the streets of this country to be safe for gay people to be able to walk down the street hand in hand. And I want the aisles of the churches to be just as safe for gay couples to be able to walk down hand in hand and get married at the altar. I don't find huge opposition in my congregation. I don't find huge opposition in my denomination. I found the opposition that there is getting louder, more shrill, more angry. But it doesn't represent the whole. It doesn't represent all of us. And a lot of the trouble in the churches is about trying to contain that and trying to deal with these very angry people. We're on a journey. I mean, things are changing. And even in the churches that you expect opposition to lie, like the Catholic Church or like the evangelical churches, things have changed. Lay people make their own minds up about things now, and that's a good thing.
How do you feel your position's changed in the past few years, these reforms going through?
My own position?
Yeah. No, your position within the church and other people's interaction with you. And how.
Well, I remember when I came out. I mean, I came out in the pulpit. I came out in a sermon. And that coming out story beats almost everybody else's coming out story. any gay dinner party I go to, I win. But I can remember when I came out, I was in a small church in Bridge of Allen, very nice part of Scotland. The people there were very good, very kind. They didn't want to talk about it a huge amount, but they were very supportive to me. But I genuinely thought that I would never work in another job again. Now, that's not that long ago. That's 10 or 11 years ago. I thought that by doing that, I would not work again. And I was starting to think, well, what will I do? You know, when I've had enough being here, what will I do next? Now, within a few years, I found that I was being offered a role in an interesting big job in Glasgow that would give me a certain amount of opportunity to campaign, to make a noise. And it wasn't just that they knew that I was gay, they took me on because I was. So that's how much things have changed for me.
Do you ever find that you're silenced, or people from above feel that you shouldn't be speaking out about this?
Not really. Most church people in my denomination can't be moved from their job by their bishop. Their bishop can be cross with them, and I have known that. But they can't actually move you. And that gives you a certain power just to speak. And it gets to the point, I mean, this business about coming out of the pulpit, it got to the point for me where I just had to say, is it worth doing this job if you can't tell the truth? And I got to the point where I thought, actually, if I can't tell the truth about me in this place, I can't do this job, because it is about integrity or it's nothing. And that's a position which is a pretty powerful one. If you've got somebody saying that, what can you do with them? So no, I don't find myself silenced. I find myself very frustrated sometimes. I find myself getting angry. But no, I'm not silenced at all. I guess some people are. I guess some people are very nervous.
Chris and Elizabeth, do you also feel that within the university or with any jobs that you've had, that you've been either silenced or advantaged?
Go after you.
Oh, yeah. When I first came to St. Andrews 7 years ago, after perhaps my first year, I said to my newly formed department, we've only been here for 9 years, that I was very interested in teaching a course on queer cinema, and I was told two things: nobody's going to come, and oh, you don't want to call it queer cinema. I was sort of quite begrudgingly agreed to call it something which actually now I far prefer. This particular course anyway is called Film and Sexual Identities, and students seem to be very, very interested in it, and it's great. So I have to stress that the people who told me that are not people above. They were my colleagues who were younger than me and who just thought, ooh, you know. They were not at all themselves necessarily homophobic or anything like that. They just thought, you know, that's a bit of a dodgy sort of potentially controversial course. Mm-hmm. So on the whole, I also want to say that teaching this particular course, but also teaching about these issues in our other courses, I've been incredibly pleased to see how actually my new colleagues have been really very interested in, and also how the kind of students who are interested belong to every possible group. And so my experience has been really positive.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say generally it's been fine for me. I mean, obviously I don't have the same questions surrounding integration of queer topics into my work. I mean, there are...
Why not?
Quite sadly, actually, there is no queer theory angle on physics. And one of my sort of passing career ambitions is to create one. But it's... I guess... There's nobody among my colleagues who has, to my face, been worse than slightly prim. And that's not too bad, right? I mean, it's we're only a few decades after getting kicked to death in public toilets, right? So slightly prim as the worst you experience is kind of okay. But there are also standout examples of colleagues who are really, really go the extra mile to make one feel comfortable. And those people are great. So I have a few colleagues where if I meet them in the coffee room, we just kind of gay it up locally. But more often, it's just quite businesslike. But, you know, there are things like Project Juno and these sort of diversity programs. I coordinate Project Juno in the School of Physics and Astronomy. And so those things are positive. There's a growing sort of management awareness that actually these things matter and you're throwing away a lot of potentially really useful talent if you start... You know, if you systematically under-admit women, if you systematically under-admit LGBT people, that's just a waste and a senseless waste. So I feel that even in the past few years, there's been very positive movement on that.
About recruitment, maybe, Patrick, do you have anything to add regarding...
About recruitment, I do, but it's probably more interesting to talk about schools.
Right.
I taught in two schools in Inner London. The first school I taught in was a Church of England school in Camberwell. Predominantly Nigerian kids, 96% Afro-Caribbean, mostly Nigerian kids. I didn't say anything about my sexuality because they just wouldn't have listened to me. They wouldn't have been accepting to that message at all, and I would have been, I think, unable to teach there. I then moved school, completely unrelated to that. That first school shut down, also unrelated to that. Moved school, and the second school I taught in was a lot further down its journey of improvement. It was a great school, and the education it was giving to all the pupils was excellent. They were making lots and lots of progress. At that school, there were quite a few gay teachers, including me, and the kids were like, yeah, and what? And I think that's where we need to be everywhere, and I think that demonstrates how good leadership in organisations, but in schools in particular, can make a massive difference to the culture, and the culture in which it's just not even a thing, that you can be who you want to be and it doesn't really matter. I think it all comes down to leadership wherever you're working or employed. But I think there is a shift, certainly in education, and I know a lot of charities are doing a lot of work to push this shift towards every school being more like that. I know of schools, one in North London in particular, that's implemented quite an overt policy on this, and different families, same love, everyone being equally accepted because they found that they had three or four year ones who had same-sex parents and they didn't want it to get to year four or five when kids start clocking onto this and them getting bullied. So they implemented this policy that's transformed the culture in the school overall, and the school's now massively oversubscribed because the culture is so nice. And it's not really, it was initially about LGBT, but it's not really about LGBT. It's just about everyone doing what they want and nobody really bothering. They're all there to learn. And that comes down to leadership, again, the leadership in that organisation. So I think that's what can really transform things. Mm-hmm. But also, I suppose, be very detrimental in certain situations.
Mm-hmm. Can I just echo that? My experience is similar to that. Just thinking about Sunday schools and the way churches teach children, I now have people opting to come to my church because they want their children to be brought up in an environment where it's okay for people to be gay. And so being positive about gay issues publicly, my doing that, and also, you know, gay people can teach in the Sunday school and that kind of thing, is attracting straight couples. And you know, being good to gay people is good for business, whatever sector you're in. You know, it's not just schools.
Yeah.
It's not just physics labs. It's, you know, the potential for everybody grows. So I would support that, yeah.
And I think that being positive is a big thing as well. Being positive about the advantages as opposed to kind of negative about what people might be saying. Yeah. I think just rolling with it, acknowledging it and being positive about what is happening is much more powerful than kind of shouting and fighting. I think that's a lot less effective.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone have any comments from their working group? Yeah.
Yes. Sorry, going back to sort of what yourself said about your experience of teaching in a London school, mm-hmm. how would you suggest combating the homophobic attitudes in schools, or would you suggest that's a place without the school in the home environment?
I think it can be both. I think schools have a responsibility to do it, and schools have a responsibility to do it properly. Putting up some posters is not doing it properly. But having a big push around LGBT History Month, where you properly thought about what this could lead to, in schools it can often lead to kids coming out. It can lead to kids who feel that their religious beliefs are kind of at odds with what they feel they now believe and are taught at school. So it can lead to them being quite confused. I think it's about making sure that staff are fully prepared, straight staff as well as gay staff, to answer questions on it comfortably, and making it as smooth as possible. So it's being really positive as opposed to slightly awkward and unprepared, because I think that can be very detrimental, especially when you're dealing with children, because if this is the first time they've come across something like this, that's going to be the sort of underlying lasting impression. So I think it's about dealing with it cohesively and properly and sort of strategically in each institution, and schools really have a responsibility to do that. Whatever is going on at home is fine if it's being supported at home. Well, schools find, I think, generally, talking to the education officer at Stonewall, he says that schools that come to him that want to do this are often really worried about the parents, actually, and parents thinking, oh, being gays about sex and it's weird and it's not with our, doesn't fit with what we believe. So inviting them to come in and look through what the kids are going to be taught, and to see that it's kind of about love. It's nothing sexual. They're like year threes. That's not relevant. And making them feel comfortable is important as well.
There's a responsibility not just for the schools, though. It's also a responsibility for government to make sure that education guidelines give schools clear indications that they should be teaching equality, that they should be promoting equality, not just LGBT equality, but other forms of equality. And I just wanted to say that it is to the shame of the churches that faith schools are places where kids are more likely to be bullied and experience homophobia. It is also the case that those schools have been given opt-outs on and different educational guidelines by government, and where governments give space for homophobia, it exists. So there is a real need to campaign to tighten those things up. And I bet Tom would just love to tell you all about the consultations that are on your seats that have a question about that. Is that fair?
Well, it looks like I'm going to have to now.
because it's a question in this consultation that you're all sitting on, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I'd add to that is if you look at the work that's going on in Scotland, there is some good practice in schools who are working with organisations like LGBT Youth Scotland, who are one of our partner organisations who work specifically on education and with young people. But it is still a minority of schools. And even though we had the homophobic Section 28 repealed over a decade ago, I still think there's a knock-on impact of that, whereby a lot of schools haven't made the progress in feeling comfortable talking about LGBT people and LGBT issues. We're currently seeing in the same-sex marriage consultation that's happening, groups like Scotland for Marriage, who actually oppose same-sex marriage, calling for a range of changes to education. They want changes such as primary schools to be banned from mentioning same-sex relationships and same-sex marriage. They want parents to have a new right to withdraw their children from any lessons that mention same-sex relationships or same-sex marriage. And they want teachers to have the right to teach that same-sex relationships are wrong. And, you know, one of my worries coming out of this is often when we make steps forward for LGBT equality, as we hopefully will when it comes to equal marriage in Scotland, there is also the potential that we could go back a few steps in other areas. So whilst the government might, you know, whilst our politicians might vote for equal marriage, they might also feel more timid because of the backlash that there has been from some parts of Scottish society when it comes to having a proactive agenda, for example, in education and making sure there's not discrimination in schools and that education can be inclusive. So, you know, lots of good practice out there, but it's still only a minority of schools in Scotland that are actually proactively working to eliminate discrimination against LGBT people and make what is taught more inclusive.
In terms of being proactive, and what this leads us quite neatly onto one of our next questions, which is, do you agree with the advantages by positive discrimination in investment banks, the police force, and in recruitment? Patrick?
Yeah. I, on principle, don't really agree with positive discrimination ever, because, well, I think especially in recruitment, it's important to recruit the best people for the job. If I recruited someone, it was on the basis of them being gay, they could be a terrible teacher. So that's not a great way to recruit people. I think big recruiters, small recruiters can do is make sure that they're targeting groups like LGBT groups, other groups at universities, as well as they are more sort of traditional societies that they kind of sponsor and push. I think it's about awareness within the LGBT community. Obviously, recruiters try to create awareness within the whole university community, but it's making sure that there aren't idols of that community that you're missing out, that you make everyone aware and everyone has equal opportunity to apply and demonstrate that they're great for the investment bank or their management consultancy or whatever it is they want to go on and do.
I completely agree. I mean, I don't believe that discrimination can ever be positive, no matter how many good intentions are behind the whole idea of positive discrimination. So I think what company recruiters should do, and that includes the university, is to make it clear that this is a place that welcomes people regardless of their sexual orientation as well as regardless of every other, you know, distinctive part of their identity. And that I think it's about inclusion and making it very, very clear, advertising that this is LGBT-friendly as well as a friendly, in general, sort of place. I think that will attract all sorts of people. And so, of course, as you said, the best person hopefully should get a job and should have nothing to do with whether they are gay or not. I mean, in a broader sort of sense, and something that's been perhaps longer a debate, we have, as you were saying, less women than men, for example, in positions of power at the university. I don't think the way to go would be to just make, you know, lots of women professors, because even at this basic level, I would like to be given a job not because I'm a woman or because I'm something else, but because I'm good for the job.
It's worth saying, though, that positive discrimination, it's a term that can have a whole variety of meanings. There's, you know, the Daily Mail take on it, maybe, which is that these people who aren't as good at the job are suddenly getting the job. But actually, it can simply mean things like recognising barriers and recognising different types of potential and value. So when you look at widening access, for example, to university, actually often looking at the potential, recognising that sometimes people who come from poorer and more disadvantaged backgrounds might not have the same, might not have had the same exact same grades, but when you interview them or when you speak to them on a deep level, you can see that actually they might have the potential to succeed in higher education. Positive discrimination could mean, for example, recognising that if you are disabled, particularly if you're severely disabled, you might not have the same glossy CV that everyone else might, but you might want to, for example, as some employers do, give disabled applicants a chance to have an interview at least, so you can see if you can, you know, look at their potential in other means. Of course, there is positive discrimination in the kind of more simple sense, which I think we've seen in Parliament, which is if you look at what some of the parties have done with all women shortlists. I find that difficult because on the one hand, I want to say that I don't agree with, you know, discriminating on any level, but also the reality of the situation in terms of representation in Parliament is that if we hadn't have had all women shortlists in some of the parties, we would still be where we were decades ago when it comes to women's representation in Parliament. And how many centuries do you have to wait to catch up whereby you have some level of decent representation for women in Parliament? So it's a difficult situation, and I think you have to look at the context of actually what does positive discrimination mean in each case.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that point, actually. I think the danger is that we just take this obviously attractive and very hard to argue against principle position that we will judge everyone on their merits. But isn't the point of positive discrimination that if you're in a situation where most of the people making that judgment on the merits are straight, or most of the people making that judgment on the merits are male, we have to hypothesise that they are making biased judgments, subconsciously perhaps. Or we have to say that there's an actual merit reason why there are fewer women than represented in the population in well-paying academic jobs, or fewer gay people than are represented in the population in well-paying academic jobs. I mean, I think that you've got to take seriously this question of whether, by just sticking to that apparently unbiased position of principle, we're just locking ourselves into a sort of straight patriarchy. And I'm not going to give a definitive answer to that question, but I think it's one we should take seriously. We shouldn't assume that we are capable of making unbiased decisions on the merits.
Corey? I apologise for the kind of academic response to this, but I guess what you mean, it should be all right. There's quite a famous psychological study where they were basically looking at if they were employing a police commissioner, who would people most like? And they had two candidates, hypothetical candidates. So there was a man and a woman. And for half the people that they tested, the man was your standard street bobby that has got an awful lot of experience as a policeman on the street doing day-to-day stuff. And the woman had a lot of policy-making experience. And then the other group, it was the opposite way around. So the woman had the street experience and the man had the policy experience. And in both cases, the man was selected, despite the fact that he had different criteria. And in both cases, the people that chose him said they chose him because of his good attributes. And so I think that shows that, exactly as Dr. Chris Hooley was saying, is that people don't associate the decisions that they make with discriminatory decisions, but unavoidably they do tend to be. And so I think that's a really good reason why actually we have to have positive discrimination, because that's the way that people work at the moment.
Can I add to that? And given that sometimes that discriminatory biases is just due to the fact that previously women haven't been in those positions, so people haven't seen them as being competent, sometimes if you do make positive discrimination and do put them in that decision, it leads to those biases going away, and in the long term, you don't have to positively discriminate and justice system will correct itself. It's not a long-term thing, it's probably a very short-term thing that you have to do. Maybe it's worth it. And I'm not just saying that because I'm but, you know, I just think on a principle it might be something worth considering.
And an interesting point there as well is, you know, if you look at the issue of all women shortlists, for example, it's not a case whereby you're taking a bunch of women who would be really useless at the role and putting them into Parliament. You know, you've got some amazingly capable people in Parliament. It's just, you know, simply that you're looking at how do we get more women in there who are perfectly capable as well. The other thing when it comes to positive discrimination is to say that, you know, life isn't fair. There are barriers for different groups of people. One of the things that concerns me on a slightly different issue is how much emphasis there is around internships and experience at the moment with graduates getting their first jobs. Now, the problem with internships is whilst it's great, and obviously we should commend anyone who wants to build up experience before they get their first job, the people who are more likely to be able to do an unpaid internship are people that come from wealthier backgrounds. You know, to put it bluntly, if you come from a poorer background, you're more likely at university to spend your time working in a cafe or a bar or doing something that helps you pay the bills than being able to do an unpaid internship, which then is going to make you more likely to get the better jobs when you come out of university. So, you know, there are different levels whereby barriers are created because of something that's not your fault, and it might not affect actually what your capability or potential are. So I think we've got to look at capability and potential as much as anything else.
I just wanted to say, I actually find everyone said something that they are kind of agreeing with in some way, so it's very interesting, but I was just thinking that one issue perhaps that it's important to consider, that when if we positively discriminate, and so we actively privilege a group of people because we feel that absolutely they've been historically discriminated against, depending on the context, we may, in doing that, discriminating against another group. And I think that's a very different scenario. I mean, when we're talking about politicians, we could argue that anybody who's a politician is in some way a privileged member of society. If we are recruiting in a school for teachers and we are automatically privileging a lesbian, we may actually not give a job to a working-class man who's had a bit of a shit on his life because he's been living in an area of chronic unemployment. And is that right? I don't think so. I'm not saying that there is an easy solution, but I mean, it's not that LGBT people or women are necessarily the only group that may have you know, a history of underrepresentation, or especially in such a classy society as British society, an innate difficulty of getting a job, even because of an accent or because the grammar school they didn't go to. So that doesn't take away from what, you know, Chris has said, for example. But I think it's just such a complex issue.
In a sense, we all recognise what the LGBT community has achieved in the first few years and the progress that's made. So that leads us quite nicely onto the next question. That does the panel agree that with the social inclusion of LGBT rights and the increasing acceptance of the wider community, that the LGBT community is at risk of losing its social identity?
I think it's important to say here that if you look internationally, there are still, I think, something like 70-something countries where being LGBT or homosexuality, at least, is still illegal, and in some of these countries, punishable by death. And that's not just a theoretical situation; that's something that happens. So we've still got a long way to go globally. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in Scotland, in particular, you know, we've come a long way since homosexuality was decriminalised in 1980, which I still find astounding that it was only in 1980, which was 5 years before I was born. It was still illegal. And we've come a long way in terms of legal change. So same-sex marriage is probably the final major piece of legislative change required for LGBT people, at least, to provide full legal equality. And yes, social attitudes have changed. Still not exactly where we want to be. Most of the polls, for example, issues like same-sex marriage show about a quarter of the population oppose same-sex marriage. If you look at what people think of same-sex relationships, it's not far off that either. But I don't know, because I think people are always going to associate to some degree in different groupings. I don't think it's just because LGBT people have faced prejudice that you see situations whereby you get, you know, gay bars or LGBT people grouping together. Just as it's not the case that just because women have faced prejudice that, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you get women hanging out with each other or men will like to hang out with each other. I think it's just people associate around things which are common to their lives. You know, there'll still be elements of being LGBT where there will be commonality, where there still might be distinctive sexual ways of going. So I don't know. I don't think it needs to. If you look at somewhere like Brighton, where I'm from, there's a diverse LGBT culture there. Lots of different things for people to do. Lots of different types of venues as well. So I don't know. I don't think it needs to.
I think with some of the clients that I have, it's that they don't realise their own sexuality. If you're in an environment where it's, as you said quite correctly, it's illegal to have same-sex acts, there's no positive discrimination of any sort in Uganda, you're left with this situation. And a lot of my clients, they come to the UK and they're faced with an authority. The first thing you meet as an asylum seeker is UKBA. Anybody meet them? Not most pleasant of people, are they? And in that first initial interview with authority, you've got to disclose that you're homosexual. Well, for the last so many years, or the whole of your life, you've never admitted it, maybe not to yourself or to anybody. So they make their claim on a lot of our clients on totally false grounds, or on grounds that really aren't the truth. It's that underlying psychological thing that they haven't come out. And we see clients who come out 5 years into the asylum process, and they're late coming out, they get no legal support, they get no help from the government, and we're left with somebody who's going to court by themselves to try and represent themselves and say, look, the real reason was I'm actually gay, but it's taken me all this time to come out. And unfortunately, as you've seen in the press recently, the Home Office just generally saying about 75% of cases, oh, we just don't believe you, what's the proof? What's the proof? Well, it's very, very difficult, and people have been submitting, and this is to the lens, I've seen this in my client files, photographs of oral sex between two men, videos, footage is quite common now, just to prove a point. And I think it's a really sad reflection on society that we just, that is the only proof that seems to be acceptable to the Home Office in so many cases. And in a culture that actively promotes, you know, LGBT rights. So it's disappointing from my point of view that people have to resort to this length of basically publishing things that would be very private. Nobody here would want to publish such things.
Do you think the UK is doing enough to support...
It's moving forward.
...countries like Uganda?
It's moving forward. Before 2010, there was the kind of Home Office's approach was people could just be discreet about their sexuality. It was a fantastic man called Lord Hope who actually said, well, if you're gay, you should be able to... I didn't quite approve with his wording. You should be able to listen to Kylie Minogue and drink baby sham without the fear of discrimination. Well, thanks to him, we don't have the discreet issue anymore. I was disappointed there wasn't any baby sham this evening, just pork. And we move to this issue of proof now. So there has been some movement. 98% of LGBT cases were refused previously. We're now down to 75%. That has to be seen as a positive step forward. Not fantastic, but we're slowly getting there. And I think it's because, obviously, our name from our charity is called No Going Back. We took the name from the Stonewall report about how LGBT asylum seekers are treated. And there is definitely a move forward, but still a long way to go. And I think there's this huge issue about how do you evidence sexuality? I'd be really interested to hear from anybody here how they would evidence, other than photographs... and video footage, how they would actually evidence sexuality. I mean, anybody actually here? Yeah. Right, please.
Well, my contribution would be that what they claim that is proof isn't actually proof, because it's such an internal psychological thing. There's no way of, we don't even understand it. But kind of going back to the idea of loss of identity, I think we should question whether that loss of identity is a negative thing. I would argue it's perhaps a positive thing that we are accepting that people who are homosexual aren't this gay stereotype, but it's in fact something broader, and it's a spectrum of sexuality. So this diffusion of identity is just the first step of a greater movement of accepting a whole spectrum, a whole range. So when identity becomes diffused, then stereotypes also become diffused.
I mean, at the risk of getting all critical theory, the identity that we think we're losing has only really existed for 100 or 120 years, and it's more or less a medical classification. The old laws were not against homosexuality; they were against buggery. And you read writings at the time. There's the idea of associating those acts with an identity is quite a new idea, and it may be one that will pass. I wouldn't guarantee that in 100 or 150 years' time people will be talking about being homosexual. The other point I'd make, though, and I'm glad Stonewall came up, is that, of course, when part of a community assimilates to the mainstream, there's always some fraction left on the margin. And if you look at the people who were actually conducting the fighting outside the Stonewall Bar, they didn't look a lot like us. So there is a negative side, I think, to the LGBT community assimilating, which is that we've historically made common cause with people whose tastes, appetites, activities were also considered illegal. Some of them are still considered illegal. And probably the price of our assimilation is we won't make that common cause anymore. And that's kind of a shame. I mean, there are certain sadomasochistic practices that are still not allowed between consenting adults. There are certain polygamous practices which at least don't get the legal support that sort of two-member relationships are now getting. So I don't want to sound too negative. I mean, I think it's great that we're moving this way, but there's always someone who looks at these things and says, well, that's not for me either. And it's important not to forget those people.
Those are the people that fall between the cracks, yeah. Because they're not wearing a pink feather boa. They're not wanting to be going to GAY every weekend. And they do assimilate to society. And their sexual orientation is just a part of them. But it's a huge issue if they were being active and being themselves in their own country.
It's quite important to remember that the gay population has never mapped entirely onto the gay community.
Yeah.
Or the gay scene. I mean, those are kind of decreasing. They embrace a number of people in a decreasing way, don't they?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the gay population is entirely different to a group of people who behave in the same way, think the same way, do the same thing, associate with one another. I mean, it's just not the way it is.
Yeah.
It never has been the way it is. And yet, yes, I feel nostalgic when I think that when I was here nearly 25 years ago, and in the few years after that, there was a good gay bookshop in Edinburgh that I used to find very supportive. I used to go to it, and I used to like the fact that it was there, and I was sad when it closed. There are more gay books available to people now, and there are more people out, and we don't have that bookshop. I feel the nostalgia, but I have to face the fact that it's probably nostalgia, I think.
I'm not sure this book, but last year a book came out by a major queer theory student, David Halperin, who comes, and I'm going to get super critical here. He's like a social constructionist, and it's called How to Be Gay, but it's like an academic book. And kind of the culminating line is he says, sometimes I think homosexuality is wasted on gay people. and a big argument, the overriding argument of the book is kind of this apology for loss, what he sees as lost gay culture that's come with assimilation. He makes kind of the radical argument that that you know people are falling through the cracks because are willfully trying to act differently. They're trying to conform more so than before to kind of these heteronormative ideas about behavior. And I'm just curious if you guys would agree with that sort of argument. It seems like, you know, more so than I was expecting, that this panel at least would actually agree with that sort of idea.
Well, it seems to me that really you are bringing up the debate about identity politics versus politics of difference. Mm. I mean, again, not to bring up too much critical theory, but I mean, historically, there's been a shift, although it certainly hasn't been an undebated shift, and not for everyone agrees, from gay and lesbian politics to queer politics. For the people who have followed the shift, who agree, they feel that gay and lesbian had a very, very important place at a certain historical time, but that they have become, or they could become, potentially limited and oppressive categories. And so the sort of emergence in critical studies of queer is because it's seen as a word that doesn't really prescribe them much, but it's more a word that accepts a very vast gamma of difference, of sort of what you may call sexual deviation or identity deviation from anything that is not normative. But I think this is a very, very difficult issue, and I think perhaps we don't have to necessarily give up one for the sake of the other. I mean, perhaps it depends on the context. There may be contexts in which we may feel it's a matter of life and death, and indeed it may be, to say that we identify with a certain sexual identity. But on the other hand, certainly I also see from discussion I've had with students, a lot of people find that it's actually quite liberating to say, I don't have to necessarily say I'm gay or I'm straight, because I feel that those words actually tell me to do some things and not to do some others, or they tell me that I'm going to be this way forever and I may change. So I don't think there's a definite answer, but I think perhaps it's a constant dialectics between the two positions. I don't know.
I definitely find that one of the arguments being that we're trying to fit in more with society. I mean, just because I wear a dress means that I'm not a stereotypical gay person. But you find that it actually does the opposite of what everyone thinks. So if in the straight community, I'm still a lesbian. So if I was to come against somebody who was homophobic, I still have a problem. But then also in my own community, if I'm to go out, there's often a question of whether or not I actually am a lesbian and my integrity, because I don't look like them. So I think that, would you not find that it's kind of one of these things that we're never really going to solve it, because no matter what, somebody's always going to have a problem with how you're behaving.
Actually, I'm going to propose this question, actually. And I guess it all came up to this idea of any gay community has to be straight acting. And I'm not really sure whether that is fitting in with society and what you think you should be, or whether that's just a progression of, if, you know, how gay people are. You know, that's the reason I propose that question. You know, is it a societal thing, or is it just a personal identity moving forward?
I guess I would like to know what you mean by straight acting, exactly.
Well, if you talk to a lot of gay people, they find the idea of being overtly homosexual a little bit strange. So they'll say they're straight acting. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear that quite often, especially at the university level.
Right.
So that's quite a common thing to hear.
Okay. It's certainly something which you expect to be included in personal. Someone should tell you whether they're straight acting or not when they place a personal advertisement.
What kind of
Yeah, okay. But, I'm old-fashioned, I like the paper-based thing.
Do you mean straight acting or do you mean gay denying? That's what I'm wondering.
I'm not sure it's gay denying. I mean, if you're putting an ad in a section of the paper that says "men seeking men," you're saying something, aren't you? But even lots of those advertisements make a point of saying, you know, I'm straight acting,
yeah.
As in, you know, the idea being that one of the broad categories of sexual preference that I might have towards another man is whether they act gay, and people seem to make a choice about that. They only mention it if they're straight acting. The assumption is that they're gay acting, unless... Yes.
denying. I don't think we're denying it, because if anything, I'm quite an activist, yet. I mean, I'm not, again, not stereotyped. I've never, ever been pointed out as being, yeah, I've never walked into a job and I've ever been assumed that I'm interested in men, and that's never, ever been a question. And it's not that I'm denying it. If it were to bring it up, I would quite obviously say, no, actually, you've got that wrong. But it's not that I'm denying it, it's just, it's not the one part of me that everybody that's on show, and it's not that I don't want it to be on show, it's just not. And I think it's a shame if people think that we have to be one way and that we should be able to announce it to the world just by walking into a room. Because then what would be the point of coming up if we just announced it instantly?
Just curiously, would you say you were straight acting, or would you just say you were that person? Would you identify as me?
I think I'm a woman. Is that not an option?
That's perfect.
I think that's an interesting issue, because we should also not assume that straight acting could be defined in, if we assume that all straight people are actually heteronormative, because they are not. So, you know, there is a sense by which I could be straight, but actually find that I actually don't fit in a very radical way most of the expectation placed on me as a straight woman. So it just gets more and more complex, and I think it is perhaps about being, it sounds corny, but being really whatever you are and you feel like doing. I mean, if you feel like dressing with a pink feather boa, well, that's fine. And I mean, maybe you're not gay though. I mean, you just like a pink feather boa. I mean, it's difficult, but yeah.
I think these are really complex areas, and I'm in the rather bizarre position of working in an organisation with lots of gay acting straight people. There's nothing more fun than a clergy conference. They can't all be gay.
For me, this debate just raises lots of questions as well. I mean, I'm hesitant. I don't like the term straight acting, because for me, I've always personally associated that with what Calvin was saying about gay denying. People are making a point about saying that they're straight acting. What are they actually trying to say? But I think it's important to say that there are, and this might sound a bit corny and cheesy as well, but there are as many different ways to be LGBT as there are LGBT people. So, you know, you get LGBT people who are, you know, more masculine, more feminine, interested in sport, not interested in sport, religious, not religious, enjoy coming to debates, don't want to come to debates.
Everybody enjoys coming to debates.
But I think it's also interesting, though, because this raises lots of questions, actually, for me, more about human nature generally. Because isn't it true, as much as we might say, well, we don't want to, or we do want to define ourselves by our sexual orientation, society, to some degree, is about people grouping with each other on the basis of a whole range of different things, whether it's religion or their gender or what types of pub they like to go to, or a whole range of different things. But then on the other hand, in society, actually to a certain degree, everyone does try to assimilate to some extent. I remember when I was in primary school and everyone had to have Adidas poppers and, you know, a Master System or a Mega Drive and a PlayStation and so on to be part of the IT crowd. So, you know, it just raises lots of questions about to what extent, as humans, do we try to group ourselves? Do we try to assimilate to what we think everyone else is comfortable with? But I think, you know, like you were saying, as long as you're comfortable with who you are, be as gay or flamboyant or whatever as you want to be, or don't be that, you know, just do what makes sense for you.
We've discussed gay issues greatly, but one of the main issues that's come out in these questions is, when equal marriage comes into effect, what does this mean for people of the transgender community? Will they be fully equal? What do you think about that question?
No. So, for anyone who doesn't know, one of the changes that is being made currently as part of the change to the law to allow same-sex marriage is that the government is looking into gender recognition. So, at the moment, if you want to legally change your gender in terms of all of the documents that you have in society, you have to get something called a gender recognition certificate. And this is something that's been in place since about 2004. Prior to that, there was no specific way of doing that. The problem comes with
somebody who is in a marriage. So if you're transgender but you're married to someone at the moment, obviously, of the opposite sex, well, I don't particularly like that term, but you cannot get a gender recognition certificate without first divorcing. Because of the way the law was set up, in part because there was no such thing as same-sex marriage, and the government, when it was creating civil partnerships, didn't want to get into the whole same-sex marriage debate. So one of the things that hopefully, and I'm sure it will be solved, we're certainly working very closely with politicians on this, is that that scenario will no longer happen. A transgender person will no longer have to choose between getting divorced and having their true gender recognised under the law. But is that going to create full equality? No, it's not. I think trans people are probably the group in society, to some extent, that are most discriminated against still. We talk about public attitudes coming along progressively towards LGBT equality. Well, you know, we're probably about a decade ahead when it comes to sexual orientation than we are when it comes to gender identity. And around the world, still, people are regularly, on a daily basis, murdered because they are trans. In our own streets, they're called names. You know, I won't repeat some of the names, but I'm sure you could all think about names that people use and jokes that people make about trans people. So, socially, is it going to create equality? No. Hopefully, there will be some progress. Whenever a new piece of LGBT equality legislation is passed, over time, we do see some change in social attitudes. There are also some legal equality issues as well. And then there's practical discrimination. So, you know, OK, it's not legal for an employer to say, I'm not going to pick you as a candidate for employment because you're trans. But there are ways in which you can essentially choose not to employ someone because they're trans by coming up with other reasons for why you've done that. So it's not going to create full equality, but it's a step forward.
Speaking of anti-LGBT language, one of the questions that was submitted was regarding the panel's views on people within the LGBT community who actually use anti-LGBT language. Do you think it's justified when a transgender person uses the word tranny? Do you think that's PC? Do you think this is appropriate? And in what context? Could it be justified as a joke?
I think if you look back, it's the equivalent of a black person using the word nigger. Today, I'm certainly not comfortable with hearing that word. I think it depends on the context. I think it's how it's used. I know that Stonewall are certainly focusing on in schools about, because one of them, I've worked in a school before, and, you know, kids would say, oh, he's so gay. But not in a positive way. I think it's challenging how the terminology is actually used. And I would hope that with such projects with Stonewall, we will actually change the usage of these words to, so it actually being so gay is a positive thing in a school. I don't know if your project's actually covered other work.
Yeah. What's interesting about it is that if you're working with younger kids, especially at primary school, anecdotally from what teachers that I've spoken to have said, once primary school kids are educated on what it means, they don't use it anymore. And it's kind of a fad. They'll use another word. Like, just use a gay because it's a word. Like,
yeah.
Give them another word and they'll use that instead once you've told them what gay means. So the sentiment behind it isn't actually that you're so gay and that's really bad. Yeah. It's just...
It's an internal
word
insult,
that
yeah.
Bad. So
where do you think they get that from, though?
I think that probably comes from home. I think it comes from when that was used more widely in society. By not necessarily older people, but I don't know, I suppose they're older brothers and sisters, and it just filtering down.
Yeah.
And I think that's disappearing. Mm-hmm. Not everywhere, but it's starting, it's disappeared somewhere, and it's starting to disappear in other places, just because it's kind of going out of fashion.
I think...
I've actually worked as a teacher for a while, and I had my mentor...
who was the one that was meant to support me in my position, and she would frequently use, say, that's so gay, that's so gay. And she knew that I was gay, and eventually I did say to her, you know, that does make me uncomfortable. And her response was, well, that's just gay. And I didn't know how to handle it, and I never spoke to anyone else about it because it wasn't overtly homophobic, but I did feel it was disrespectful. And the fact that she was a teacher, she was the one that was going into the classroom to teach these kids not to do, to say these things, and then she would walk into the staff room and just say things that I felt were completely offensive.
I think sometimes it's not necessarily about educating the kids, it's about educating the teachers first so that they can educate the kids. Which is possibly more difficult because they've already got things, learned behaviours.
Matt?
I think there is, potentially some value in appropriating the word, in taking something that is derogatory or is insulting, and being able to embrace it, and being able to say, yes, that was an insult to me at one point in my life. It's not something that I can say. You still can't say it, but I can say it. And there's you can turn into things with a bit of pride. And the example I want to use for two reasons is the word fag, which as a kid was something I heard and hated and loathed. Then I came here, and as a smoker, I heard the word all the time, and it confused me. And every time someone said going out for a fag, I like recoiled for a second when I realized they're talking about cigarettes. But I've actually tried in a few occasions to actually just use the word. Yeah, I'm a fag. And there is a certain power to that, taking that word that used to be so hurtful and to making it something that you can... I think it's part of accepting yourself, accepting your identity, and I think there is a strength to it, and part of it probably runs counter to the idea of taking a phrase like that, so again, trying to get it out of the language we use, but at the same time, words have the meaning we give them. And I think there is a real ability to consciously take derogatory terms and try to make them self-empowering.
That's being exactly that point, I think, is being built upon by some recruiters in partnership with Stonewall. I know they've been talking to the Army about adverts where there's Army officers recruitment adverts that say things like, being in the Army, that's so gay. So doing exactly that, taking it and finding something that people want and calling it gay, kind of rebranding it. But I suppose there's arguments both ways.
David?
Just to sort of add to the whole discussion about changing the word, I mean, language is a living thing. Ask any linguistics, they'll always say the meanings of words have changed. Language is always evolving. Look at German. German's changed dramatically in the past 400 years. I mean, back 17th century English, to call women nice was a horrendous thing. You're basically calling her a prostitute. Like, it's, I think, what needs to be addressed, and the way that gay people use, black or LGBT people use language like that's so gay, or the way it is changing the meaning of it, and I think that is what you're alluding to with it. It's not something that is impossible, it's something that should be encouraged, sort of.
Well, the word gay has changed quite radically from being happy. My mother still uses it. She's getting used to terminology. When I spoke to her a few weeks ago, when we set the we just set the charity up in the last year, she thought LGBT was a type of sandwich. So education is a really crucial part in kind of building bridges between generations and natural use of language. So
we're all here for Queer Question Time tonight as well. Yeah. Queer is a word that has changed hugely. Mm. I mean, I can remember times when that simply would not have been an acceptable thing to put on, and it wouldn't have been an acceptable thing for a community to own as a word. So, you know, these words do change, and people can adopt them and take some of their power. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
But I think...
I just wanted to add, I was going to say exactly what Kelvin said, and I mean... talking about my field and critical theory, quite a recent development has been emerging of queer studies and disability studies, and that has led to something called CRIP theory. And CRIP comes from cripple. And this is a word by no means used and liked by everybody, but increasingly used by disability activists. And they also talk about coming out as CRIP in case they have an invisible disability. So although this is a word which provokes strong reaction and debate, I think it's a good example of how it may be possible to reclaim a word such as queer, or such as gay and other words, which were very offensive, and actually turn into something powerful and self-affirming.
I was just going to add that I think it's important not to... It's important that this is the kind of thing that comes from the grassroots. I don't think there's ever been any value in establishing a party line on these matters. It also tends to endow it with what I feel is probably an excess of significance. I mean, there's a lot more to people than language they use and the way they choose to express things. I won't immediately assume that someone is a devil because they use the term tranny, and I won't assume they're a saint because they don't. It's one of 100,000 things you should use in drawing your opinions on people. I think it's very dangerous to have rules that say, oh, this is always offensive. Because for anything that you say is always offensive, you can think of someone you know who said it and it wasn't.
I think there is a problem, though, where when you're reclaiming words, what if not everyone who defines in that community or communities wants to reclaim it? So, I mean, the Equality Network's just set up a new policy body with sports groups in Scotland because did a piece of research and recognised that there is massive homophobia still in Scottish sport. Would we be comfortable if the solution that some of the organisations came out with was, or we'll run some posters saying, you know, homophobia, that's so gay? I don't know, because a lot of people aren't comfortable with that. Some people might be comfortable with the term tranny. Other people certainly would not be comfortable with that. So I think there is a question of how do you balance if some people want to reclaim the word and others don't. You know, that's an interesting dynamic to the debate too.
We've talked about linguistic representations, but one of the questions that have been submitted is, in TV shows such as Glee, which heavily feature and promote the LGBT community, often stereotypically LGBT characters are depicted. Is it difficult to portray the LGBT characters without turning them into potentially offensive generalisations?
I think Hollyoaks have done a good job.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ordinary gay person is quite well portrayed in such programmes as Hollyoaks, but I'm not overly keen on Glee, not that I watch it too often, but they're kind of... the stereotype actually gets viewers. And I think programmes like Glee play on that slightly, while Hollyoaks is just not an issue. It's incorporated into the story, far more inclusive. They don't put the limelight on that type of relationship. It's just there within the kind of context of what they're filming. In reality, the stereotype is far more exciting than the real thing. It's quite dull.
Actually, we received a very similar question about gay cinema. So, does gay cinema portray real-life LGBT experiences, or does it do nothing more than confirm social stereotypes and increase bullying and narcissism in the workplace?
Right, well, first of all, I would say, what is gay cinema? Is it cinema made by gay people, cinema for gay people, is cinema representing gay people? I mean, perhaps all of this. I mean, perhaps because I'm used to use queer cinema, which is a much broader term, but even there, it has to be debated. I guess it depends what you make of your representation. I mean, representation is never a very easy issue. I think there are some stereotypes which we'll probably all agree are just unbelievably offensive, and we wouldn't want to see them anywhere. But I think the problem with stereotypes is there are some grey areas. And often, some stereotypes can be sort of humorously or creatively used by the same people who are actually being stereotyped. So I think provided films are not deliberately offensive, I can't see how they will increase bullying. And I'm thinking it's not, I think, sometimes so much the way a character is constructed, the way he or she looks or what he does, is what the film does with it. And I was thinking in terms of films, I don't know if anyone knows the work of Pedro Almodovar. Anyway, he's a very famous filmmaker. He happens to be a gay man. And his films are very, very much about the whole spectrum of sexual difference from transsexual people to incredibly deviant heterosexual people, gay and lesbians, and the whole lot. His style as a filmmaker is extremely camp, extremely flamboyant, colours, over the top. And so his characters, regardless of the sexual orientation, are like that. But I think what's important is that he makes his film in a way that us, as the audience, identify with these characters, regardless of who we are. We like the transsexual character, the protagonist, because they are the good characters, they are interesting, they are lovable, they are beautiful, whatever it is. And so I think at that point, the stereotype is not so much that it's not there, but it acquires some dignity. And I also think that with some stereotypes, you know, if we have a character featuring the pink boy you were saying, well, what if someone wants to wear a pink boy? I mean, that should also be allowed. So I think it's the dignity given to the representation, I think, more than the actual representation itself. I don't know if that makes sense.
I think Glee's been more varied than people...
I obviously haven't watched enough episodes.
You've been busy watching Hollyoaks, that's what you've been doing. I think that there's a range of characters in Glee, actually. Kurt is the one people often talk about, who is, I think, living through a bunch of stereotypes, but there are other gay characters. Mm-hmm. And I just remember growing up in a time where there were no gay characters on the television. Uh-huh. And to the thought that there are characters now that people can see and talk about is a huge step forward. Now, yeah, there might be some stereotypes involved in that. There were no gay men on the television. There were certainly no gay women on the television. I mean, Glee, you've got characters, you know, you've got young lesbians in Glee. You've got Santana, is it Santana and Brittany? Is that right? I'm doing well, aren't I? But you've also got, you've got another stereotype in the kind of, the kind of butch jock who is bullying Kurt but really wants to kiss him. You know, the closeted stereotype is also there. And I mean, Glee's playing out some of those stories, but they're stories that need to be played out in front of people. And they're not always predictable. So I'm not too hard on Glee, just because there's visibility there, mm-hmm. and there's people that have not been seen at all. So I don't feel too worried about that, so long as there's a range of other stuff going on as well.
Do you think it's because it's more for an American audience and that the American audience is different to the audience of Hollyoaks? And that American society maybe isn't as accepting as the UK society?
I think that's true, actually. Yeah, I do think that's true. And, I mean, for so long, Hollywood itself has found it very difficult to portray anything physical with gay characters, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, European cinema has found that much easier, I think, than Hollywood. Would that be fair?
I think so. Yeah, definitely. And a bunch of other things.
And a bunch of other things, yeah. But that's a fairly simplistic way of looking at it. So I think that's probably true with programmes like that too.
I would just comment that everyone uses stereotype, really.
You know, yeah, they are.
The Asians are smart, the jocks are stupid. Like, it's a very simplistic...
They'd be a lot easier to represent in court, I can assure you.
One thing I'm glad that's changing now, though, is I remember when I was growing up, a lot of the LGBT representation on television would be around particular storylines that were just about that character coming out and having problems with it, and then they would leave the series. And I think what we're seeing now is a change whereby actually you just have characters who happen to be LGBT. Sometimes they might have storylines which are particularly revolved around their sexual orientation or gender identity, but they're retained in the programme and they have other things that happen to them as well. And I think it's good to get that balance, because obviously there will always be a desire, well, not always necessarily, but a desire for people to want to see whether it's a coming out story or something that revolves around sexual orientation or gender identity. But equally, it's good to see that actually, you know, we exist in everyday life and other things happen too. Yeah.
I think domestic violence within gay relationships is something that really needs to be pushed. Yeah. We it's almost invisible. And a lot of people, especially the people I represent, they're not even educated in that, to actually know to come out and say something until the relationship has actually fallen apart. And then we're looking retrospectively at cases where they have been a victim of domestic violence, but they couldn't, they just thought it was just part of the relationship because it's all been so new to them. I think education plays a, sorry, television plays a huge, and movies as well, a huge part in education, because for a lot of people, and young people particularly, that's where they're learning from. So I think what we show in schools, what we show on CITV or whatever, and other programmes, is really important, that we actually set people up to be open and understanding and have a knowledge of what, you know, a true loving relationship is, whether it be straight or gay.
We think we'll have to wrap up about now, but we've got a final question, which Leah, do you want to read out?
Yeah, it's been submitted to be answered by people who have been around St Andrews for a while, so anyone on the floor, if you have an answer, feel free to speak up. Have you seen the support from LGBT and the involvement of LGBT in people's lives at uni in St Andrews? And how has this developed over time? And how does this link with developments UK and worldwide? If we've got anyone to speak about that.
I guess I'll start that. I was sitting on the committee for quite some time as a welfare officer last year for Saints LGBT, so I also had quite a bit of involvement with the union and other organisations. So I guess I have seen a bit of progression over the 3 years I've been here, but I think that's also representative nationally as well. I think a lot of things have changed, and a lot of attitudes have changed in St Andrews as well. And being a subcommittee has helped us. We've had a bigger platform which to speak. I mean, it's changed quite rapidly, I think. And I think a lot of people in St Andrews now realise what we actually do rather than what we don't do. So I think that's actually changed quite significantly.
I think also we've been lucky to be at uni at such an eventful political time where there's been a huge campaign on equal marriage, and that's sort of made the wider community more aware of what LGBT means, because we get that question a lot. Precious faith.
And you say it's not a sandwich.
It's not a sandwich. It's amazing.
That's it. Speaking on that, Precious Fair, when people actually come up to us and say, what is LGBT? I'm always a little bit shocked because, you know, it's been in the press, you know, quite a lot, and it's something that's a little bit strange still. And I always still feel a little bit, not strange saying, you know, lesbian, gay, or sexual, transgender, or what, but it's almost as if I feel you should know. You know, maybe that's just my view because I'm a gay man, but just like, surely your worldwide awareness, you know, you're in St Andrews, you must be clever. You must be the newspaper occasion. You would hope you're clever anyway. You know, so I'm just thinking, do you not see the news? Do you not see developments? Do you not look at social issues? And that still surprises me, and I think there's a lot of work to be done. Not only in St Andrews, but worldwide.
For me, coming to St Andrews, I come from a really small town in Cornwall. I was out to my community, and if something just wasn't acknowledged, no one wanted to talk about it. My ground just completely passed by. I came to St Andrews, and I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be out or not. And I was sitting down with my flatmates the first week of freshers. I turned around and said, oh, you should probably all know I'm gay. And nothing was said. Then one of my flatmates turned around and goes, oh, well, we're on that. I'm Jewish. And that was it. And it's completely changed my outlook on what it's like to be an out gay person in the community, because I've only been met with a positive response since I've been here.
Can I have a go at answering the question? Because
yeah.
My memory is longer than most people in this place. I was a student at St Mary's, just through in the quad. I came in 89 and was here till 92. And I can remember the LGBT society in the university at that time met on a Sunday evening in the chaplaincy, which was regarded as the only safe space that it could meet. I remember walking past on a Sunday night many times and not being too frightened to go in. So that kind of sets the scene for it. I remember that the windows of the chaplaincy were always very steamed up, which made me feel very excited about what might be going on in there. They were probably just boiling the kettle one more time. But I can remember it being a very, very closed group, something that was quite frightening for me. Didn't help me at all at that time. I think I'm glad it was there, and I'm sure it helped some people. But the transformation from that to a meeting like this in the scope of 20 years is something that I could never have imagined. I just could not have conceived that Lower Parliament Hall would have you here having this event. So over that period of time, you know, the changes will all have been incremental, and over the 3 or 4 year period that any student's here, they won't have noticed that much change. But it's massive. It's absolutely massive.
Well, this is our first collaboration in recent history, and we'd really like to keep this as an annual event working together. And I'd like to thank our 6 speakers that we've had tonight. So if we'd like to, a round of applause for our 6 speakers. Panel event, but for the Debating Society, next Thursday on the 28th we have our annual parliamentary debate, This House Has No Faith in Her Majesty's Government. So if you want to talk about equal marriage reform, if you want to bash the coalition government, please come along next Thursday. We've got a really great lineup of MSPs, policy advisers, people have come up from Westminster. So the Debating Society is doing really well this term, and I'd like to hand over to Leah to talk about LGBT.
Yes, next Monday at 8 p.m. we've booked Aikman's The Cellar, so the downstairs room, to hold our gay and straight alliance games. So come, it'll be fun. We've talked with the committee and created new rounds, so it'll be different from what you've seen before. Apart from that, is there anything else I should advertise?
I don't think so.
There'll be a clubbing trip on the 9th of March in Edinburgh. So, yeah, that's about it for us. But we're very pleased, and I hope that you had a good night. We'll now head
to... We're now heading to the Westport for drinks, if you want to talk about any of the issues that have come up tonight and meet the speakers and discuss their careers and what they're up to. So thanks very much.
Thank you.